The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the August 12th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's campaign in turmoil. What happened? Donald Trump's campaign was roiled by a series of damaging controversies this week as his general election race with Democratic Hillary Clinton got underway. The GOP nominee got entangled in a war of words with the parents of a Muslim American soldier who was killed in Iraq. When Republican Senator John McCain and House Speaker Paul Ryan said Trump should not have criticized parents of a fallen serviceman, Trump responded by saying he was not endorsing either McCain or Ryan in their respective reelection campaigns. He also claimed the presidential election would be rigged against him. Trump's outburst caused new rifts to open in the GOP. Party Chairman Reince Priebus was reportedly apoplectic over Trump's behavior, and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, one of Trump's most steadfast defenders, said Trump was helping Clinton win by proving he is more unacceptable than she is. The real estate mogul remained defiant, insisting Republican voters would stick with him because he would appoint conservative justices to the Supreme Court. "Even if you can't stand Donald Trump and you think Donald Trump is the worst," he said, "you're going to vote for me." Clinton launched her own general election campaign with a bus tour through the crucial battleground states of Pennsylvania and Ohio. The Democratic nominee enjoyed a large poll bounce after her party's convention last week. A CBS News poll put Clinton in the lead, 46% to 39%. In the Real Clear Politics poll average, she now leads Trump by 4.5 points. Trump said there's something phony about the new polls. Well, the editorial said, "Trump's attacks on the grieving parents of a war hero represent an abysmal new low, even for him," said the Washington Post. "His complete lack of self-control has ominous implications for how he'd respond to crises as commander-in-chief. He also again demonstrated a lack of knowledge of foreign affairs this week, denying that Russian President Vladimir Putin had invaded Ukraine. Senior Republicans keep challenging or begging their nominee to be more responsible. They should know by now that he doesn't have a clue how to do that." "Clinton is making this election a referendum on Trump," said the Wall Street Journal, portraying her opponent as temperamentally and morally unfit for the presidency. "So far, he's doing little to prove her wrong." Trump's political malpractice this week completely overshadowed a dismal report on the economy. Democrats must be amazed to have an opponent who so easily plays into their hands. What the columnist said, "Trump's campaign may be reaching a tipping point," said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. His campaign manager, Paul Manafort, reportedly has given up on trying to protect Trump from his own impulses, and other staffers are said to be suicidal. Party officials are reportedly bracing themselves for a wave of high-profile Republican defections to Clinton and actively exploring how to replace Trump if he completely self-destructs and decides to drop out. For the first time, an actual revolt of some kind is on the table. Of all the outlandish things Trump said this week, the most dangerous is that the election will be rigged against him, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com. Millions of angry diehard Trumpists will now believe that if Clinton wins, she stole the election. God knows what happens then. It was bad enough to worry about Trump winning. Now he's dangerous even if he loses. Trump was not my first or second choice as the GOP's nominee, said Hugh Hewitt in Washington Examiner. But if Clinton wins in November, she'll create a solid, lasting, almost certainly permanent majority on the Supreme Court. That's why conservatives must hold their noses and vote for Trump, because if he loses, conservatism is done. Sometimes country has to come before party, said Bret Stephens in the Wall Street Journal. With his bigotry, complete disdain for constitutional protections, and lack of basic human decency, Trump has repeatedly shown himself to be morally unfit for office, high or low. Paul Ryan and other senior Republicans think that disagreeing with everything their nominee says will make up for their shameless endorsement of him. In reality, the only way Republicans can preserve their moral and political respectability is by completely disavowing this dangerous demagogue. And a second main story, Zika outbreak in Florida prompts travel warning. What happened? U.S. health officials scrambled this week to contain a Zika virus outbreak in South Florida as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urged pregnant women to avoid an entire Miami neighborhood, the agency's first ever travel warning within the continental U.S. because of an infectious disease. Zika, which is carried by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, but can also be transmitted sexually, causes no symptoms in most of those who are infected. But it can cause microcephaly in newborns, as well as paralyzing neurological disorders in adults. 15 people in Miami have so far contracted the virus from local mosquito bites. 14 of them in the city's Mile Square Wynwood neighborhood. Aerial insecticide spraying appeared to be doing little to dent the mosquito population. This is a very difficult mosquito to control, particularly in a complex urban environment, CDC Director Tom Frieden said. More than 1,650 Zika infections have been reported in the U.S., nearly all acquired through travel to South America and the Caribbean. Congress failed to approve any funding to fight Zika before breaking for recess until September 5th. In May, the Senate passed a bipartisan $1.1 billion bill, which House Republicans then layered with what Democrats called poison pill riders that would limit funds for Planned Parenthood and Obamacare. In response, Senate Democrats refused to reconsider the House-approved rewrite. What the columnist said, "We've seen this coming for months," said Michael Mechanic in MotherJones.com. Back in May, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is leading U.S. efforts to create a Zika vaccine, predicted small local outbreaks along the Gulf Coast. The good news is that Aedes aegypti is what geneticists call a lazy mosquito. It travels only about 500 feet in its entire three-week lifespan. So chances are there's no need to freak out. Not yet, at least. "Actually, we could use a little hysteria," said Jennifer Reingold in Fortune.com. For the CDC to warn people to stay away from a part of the continental U.S. is a very big deal, not least for Florida's crucial tourism industry. The same hyperpartisan Congress that incited the Ebola panic in 2014 has done nothing to address the spread of Zika. It's shameful that President Obama, who is so fond of issuing executive orders, hasn't taken lawful steps on his own, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. He's sitting on $385 million in leftover Ebola funds, which are apparently tied up by bureaucratic federal procurement regulations. What's more, his FDA hasn't cleared trials for a promising genetically engineered mosquito whose offspring die before maturity, which could substantially shrink the infectious population. "The real problem is that we're constantly playing catch-up with outbreaks like these," said epidemiologist Stephen Morse in USNews.com. Recall that after the mosquito-borne West Nile virus appeared in New York City in 1999, almost everyone was surprised by its spread across the country. We need a special contingency fund for infectious disease emergencies. Zika may be the health crisis of the moment, but in our globalized world, we can expect many more. The controversy of the week. Trump. Did Khazir Khan doom his campaign? It was the 7 minutes that shook the convention, said Annabelle Timsit in Politico.com. And Khazir Khan's eloquent and impassioned denunciation of Donald Trump may long be remembered as the turning point of the 2016 presidential race. Among all the big-name speakers at last week's Democratic convention, the most powerful speech by far came from Khan, a 66-year-old Muslim immigrant from Pakistan. With his wife, Ghazala, at his side, Khan hailed his son, Humayun, a U.S. Marine killed in Iraq in 2004 while saving his comrades from a car bomb, as the best of America, and said that if it were up to Trump, the Muslim-baiting Republican nominee, he would never have been in America. Voice rising with emotion, Khan pulled a copy of the U.S. Constitution from his pocket and asked if Trump had ever read it, or visited Arlington National Cemetery to see the graves of fallen soldiers of every faith. "You have sacrificed nothing and no one," Khan said. The draft-dodging tycoon may never recover from those searing words, said Zachary Carabell in Politico.com. History may record this as a pivot point akin to Army Counsel Joseph Welch's televised rebuke of Senator Joe McCarthy, the anti-communist witch hunter in 1954. "Have you no sense of decency, sir?" Welch asked him. Trump's unhinged response to Khan exposed him as a man without shame, said David French in NationalReview.com. Rather than prefacing any rebuttal with words of respect for the Khans or their son, Trump first mused that perhaps Mrs. Khan had kept silent during her husband's speech because, as a Muslim woman, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. He then responded to the charge that he had sacrificed nothing with the absurd claim that "I work very, very hard, have had tremendous success," as if the chore of building a real estate empire somehow compared to the agony of sacrificing a child. Condemnation poured in from Republicans and veterans groups as well as Democrats, said Philip Rucker in WashingtonPost.com. But Trump kept digging a deeper hole. He suggested that maybe what bothered Mr. Khan more than anything else was Trump's plan to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the U.S., thus suggesting that the dignified patriot was a jihadist sympathizer. "Admittedly, Trump handled this poorly," said Damon Linker in TheWeek.com. But from the moment the Khans walked out on the stage at the Democratic convention to attack Trump and endorse his opponent, they were legitimate political targets. "The media hypocrisy here is staggering," said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Remember the Republican convention? When Patricia Smith, the mother of a CIA agent killed in Benghazi, blamed Hillary Clinton for his death, liberal pundits called her comments a tasteless weaponization of grief. So why was it heroic for Khan to attack Trump and offensive for Smith to attack Clinton? "The difference is that Trump felt a need to counterattack," said Robert Kagan in the Washington Post. "It was inevitable that he'd be heavily criticized at the Democrats' convention, just as Clinton was at the Republicans. But the thin-skinned Trump proclaimed he wanted to hit everyone who spoke out against him. Obviously, he cannot control himself, even when it's in his best interest to do so. Do we want to give a man with a serious personality defect so much power over the economy?" our foreign policy, and our nuclear weapons? As even many Republicans are now admitting, there is something very wrong with Donald Trump. Well, it was a good week for safety nets after American skydiver Luke Atkins completed the first ever successful skydive without a parachute, plunging some 25,000 feet into a large net suspended 20 stories above the ground. "If I wasn't nervous, I'd be stupid," Atkins said. It was a good week for thinking big after the federal government approved the first private space mission to the moon. Moon Express, a Florida-based company, hopes to put a lander on the lunar surface in 2017 and eventually plans to mine the moon for rare elements and metals. And it was a good week for stinking up the joint after the rare Amorphophallus titanium, also known as the corpse flower, bloomed at the New York Botanical Gardens for the first time since 1939. The plant is renowned for its pungent aroma of rotting flesh, which one young visitor said smelled worse than 1,000 pukes. But it was a bad week for wise choices after a Michigan woman attending a court-ordered class on smart decision-making was arrested while trying to escape through the ceiling of the courthouse women's bathroom. It was a bad week for dentists after the federal government dropped its decades-old recommendation to floss daily, pointing to very weak, very unreliable evidence that it helps prevent tooth decay. And it was a bad week for young love after a new study found that millennials born in the 1990s are more than twice as likely to be sexually inactive than the previous generation, partly because they find social media and other online activities more interesting. "I'd rather be watching YouTube videos," said Noah Patterson, age 18. Our briefing this week is a special report on the Olympics. The Summer Games start in Rio de Janeiro on August 5th. Here's what you need to know. Is Brazil ready for the Olympics? Most of the venues are finished, but the games could be overshadowed by the slew of problems facing the country. Its political system is in crisis. President Dilma Rousseff has been suspended and faces impeachment over allegations that she massaged the nation's accounts. And top politicians have been linked to a corruption scandal involving state-owned oil giant Petrobras. Brazil is also suffering its worst recession since the 1930s, and mass layoffs have caused the unemployment rate to hit a record 11.2%. With tax revenues shrinking, Rio's governor declared a state of financial emergency, saying there was no money to pay hospital staff and police during the Olympics, a big concern given the city's soaring crime rate. Homicides were up 15% in Rio in the first 4 months of 2016 compared with last year, and street robbery has climbed 24%. Some health experts have even called for the games to be canceled because of the recent Zika virus outbreak in Brazil. Is Zika still a threat? Yes, although scientists say that the risk of athletes and spectators catching the mosquito-borne virus is declining thanks to efforts to eradicate mosquito breeding sites. Reports of new Zika cases in Rio State dropped from about 3,000 cases a week earlier this year to just 30 cases a week in June. Still, visitors are being advised to take protective measures against bug bites, like wearing long-sleeved pants and shirts when outside. SC Johnson has partnered with Rio 2016 to make its off-brand the Olympics' first official insect repellent. And the company will distribute 115,000 free bottles of its product during the Games. But many Olympians and fans remain understandably worried about Zika, which has been linked to Guillain-Barré syndrome, a paralyzing nervous disorder, and birth defects such as microcephaly, which causes babies to be born with abnormally small heads. Have any athletes pulled out of the Games? A handful of high-profile sports stars are staying home because of Zika, which can also be transmitted through sex. Cyclist TJ Van Garderen was the first potential U.S. medal contender to withdraw, saying he worried he might contract the virus and transmit it to his pregnant wife and their unborn daughter. The world's top four male golfers, Jason Day, Dustin Johnson, Jordan Spieth, and Rory McIlroy, have also opted out. People just aren't comfortable going down there and putting themselves or their family at risk, McIlroy said. Zika isn't the only health risk in Rio. Olympic rowers, sailors, canoeists, marathon swimmers, and triathletes also have to safeguard themselves against the polluted water in the bays and lakes that host their sports. How dirty is the water? Absolutely filthy. A cleanup was promised ahead of the Games, but the state government spent only $170 million of a pledged $4 billion on the effort, citing a budget crisis. Surf still churns with sludge and garbage floats freely. In many places, raw sewage flows directly into the streams and rivers that feed Olympic sites. Foreign athletes will literally be swimming in human crap, said Dr. Daniel Becker, a Rio pediatrician, told the New York Times. The Associated Press found dangerously high levels of viruses and bacteria in the waters. In some cases, the virus loads were up to 1.7 million times the level considered hazardous on a Southern California beach. The U.S. rowing team will wear seamless double-layered unisuits made with antimicrobial material to help protect them from the contaminated water. What do organizers say about the Games problems? They concede there have been teething troubles, but insist everything will be fine. When the International Olympic Committee's head inspector, Nawal El Matuwakil, made her final visit to Rio venues in early July, she said the city was ready to welcome the world. All delayed construction, including the Velodrome, Equestrian Center, and a $3 billion subway line extension to help transport hundreds of thousands of fans and athletes, will be completed in time, she said, adding that Olympians can look forward to living in an outstanding Olympic village. But 2 weeks later, Australian athletes complained that their accommodations had blocked toilets, leaking pipes, and exposed wiring, and were unfit for habitation. On the security front, officials say 85,000 police and soldiers will be deployed to Rio's streets, twice the number at the 2012 London Games. During the Olympics, said Rio Mayor Eduardo Paes, you'll have absolute peace. How do Brazilians feel about the Olympics? Not very enthusiastic. Ticket sales have been slower than expected, with 1.7 million tickets remaining 2 weeks before the opening ceremony. 51% of Brazilians say they have no interest in the Games, according to a recent poll, while 33% show little interest. The same survey found that nearly 2 out of 3 people think hosting the Olympics will bring the country more harm than benefit. Experts say Brazilians would rather focus on their country's many crises and don't feel like putting on a show for the rest of the planet. It's like if you were ready to clean up your house and do some much-needed renovation, said political scientist Mauricio Santoro, and all of a sudden you have all these guests who might see something you'd rather hide. We'll read a few columns now. First one from the U.S., How America Became Housebound. Are Americans losing our connection to the outdoors? Asks James Campbell. As a boy, I wandered the woods and fields unsupervised from morning until dark. But today, studies show many children spend less than 30 minutes per week playing outside, and as many as 7 hours a day glued to TV screens, iPads, and video games. Their parents are no better. Adults pass 93% of their lives inside buildings or vehicles. In fact, researchers say a growing number of Americans suffer from biophobia, a fear of the natural world. In children especially, a mere flock of noisy birds or a strong wind can provoke surges of anxiety, triggering the same fight-or-flight response that evolved to protect us against deadly threats like mountain lions. That's a shame because evidence suggests that when kids actually do get daily exercise outdoors, it boosts self-esteem, problem-solving skills, cooperation, focus, and self-discipline. I've seen this in my daughters. They might grumble about going for a hike, but when we return, they have a bounce in their step. We'd all be healthier and happier if we broke the stranglehold of electronics and made room for nature in our lives. From the UK, why the English have to be insincere. Never believe an Englishman, said Andrew Brown. It's not that the English can't be trusted or that they set out to deceive, exactly. It's that lying is intrinsic to their particular form of politeness. English manners are so subtle that you should assume almost everything an upper-class English person says will be manipulative or insincere, despite hardly any of it being literally untruthful. Americans can be straightforwardly insincere. If an American says, "We must have lunch," that doesn't mean she actually wants to invite you to lunch. With the English, the phrasing is even slipperier. When it sounds as if an English person is giving you a compliment, you must carefully analyze his words to find the barb buried inside. The former Archbishop of York, for example, used to respond to ranting letters by replying, "Thank you for your communication, which I will read with the attention it deserves." This is why navigating an English conversation can be mentally stimulating yet ultimately exhausting. You must pay attention to the other person to work out all the time what they really mean. Could we ever change, drop all the subtext, and say what we mean? It might be easier, but most of us would regard such a policy as destructive of civilization. And this from Poland, reminded of our duties as Catholics. Pope Francis may have just single-handedly changed Poland's refugee policy, said Kazimierz Sowa. The ruling Law and Justice Party has been outspoken in its opposition to taking in any of the migrants from the Middle East and Africa who have flooded into Europe last year. The conservative government insists it has already done enough by allowing hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians displaced by the conflict with Russia to come to Poland for work. But on his first visit to Poland last week, the Holy Father told us that those efforts were not sufficient, and he did it without hectoring or lecturing or even mentioning the government, but merely by preaching love. It was a masterful sermon. The Pope was unequivocal about the Christian duty to take in refugees. "It is vital," he said, "that we have a spirit of readiness to welcome those fleeing war and hunger, and solidarity with those deprived of their fundamental rights." He called on the Catholic Church in Poland to lead society in helping children and families. Gently but inexorably, he held up a mirror to the Polish Church to force it to draw its own conclusions about how it has failed to live up to its mission of mercy. The government may not listen, but Poles surely did. And now the last word, our in-depth article, Marie Kondo's War on Clutter. The Japanese home organization guru has built an empire on the premise that tidying up will change people's lives, said journalist Taffy Brodesser-Ackner. Not everyone is a believer. Joy points upward, according to Marie Kondo, whose name is now a verb and whose life has become a philosophy. In April at the Japan Society in New York, she mounted a stage in an ivory dress and silver heels, made namaste hands at the audience, and took her place beneath the display of a PowerPoint presentation. Now that she has sold nearly 6 million copies of The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up and has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 86 weeks and counting, she was taking the next logical step, a formal training program for her KonMari method, certifying her acolytes to bring the joy and weightlessness of a clutter-free life to others. The 93 converts in attendance, and me, had been given lanyards that contained our information, our names, where we live, and an option of either the proud tidying completed or the shameful tidying not yet completed. In order to be considered tidy, you must have completed the method outlined in Kondo's book. It includes something called a once-in-a-lifetime tidying marathon, which means piling five categories of material possessions, clothing, books, papers, miscellaneous items, and sentimental items, including photos, in that order, one at a time, surveying how much of each you have, seeing that it's way too much, and then holding each item to see if it sparks joy in your body. The ones that spark joy get to stay. The ones that don't get a heartfelt and generous goodbye via actual verbal communication and are then sent on their way to their next life. This is the crux of KonMari, a soon-to-be trademark nickname, and it is detailed in The Life-Changing Magic and her more recent book, Spark Joy. She is often mistaken for someone who thinks you shouldn't own anything, but that's wrong. Rather, she thinks you can own as much or as little as you like, as long as every possession brings you true joy. Her book was published in the United States in 2014, quietly and to zero fanfare and acclaim. Kondo's inability to speak English made promotional radio and talk show appearances hard sells. But one day, a New York Times home section reporter happened upon the book and wrote an article discussing her own attempt at KonMari-ing her closets. The book caught fire. Soon it was the subject of every kind of press. The Adoring Profile, the Woman's Magazine Listicle, the Feminist Takedown, the personal essay, the op-ed of Harumph. By the time her book arrived, America had entered a time of peak stuff, when we had accumulated a mountain of disposable goods, but hadn't, and still haven't learned how to dispose of them. We were burdened by our stuff. We were drowning in it. People had an unnaturally strong reaction to the arrival of this woman and her promises of life-changing magic. There were people who had been doing home organizing for years, and they sniffed at her severe methods. But then there were women who knew that Kondo was speaking directly to them. They called themselves converts, and they say their lives have truly changed as a result of her decluttering methods. At the Japan Society, we were split into workshop groups where we explained to one another what had brought us here and what we had got out of the life-changing magic of tidying up. A woman named Diana said that before she tidied, her life was out of control. Her job had recently been eliminated when she found the book. It's a powerful message for women that you should be surrounded by things that make you happy, she said. And her and everyone else's faces engaged in wide-eyed, open-mouthed, incredulous agreement, nodding emphatically. I found the opposite of happiness is not sadness, Diana told us. It's chaos. Another woman said she con-married a bad boyfriend. Having tidied everything in her home and finding she still distinctly lacked happiness, she held her boyfriend in her hands, realized he no longer sparked joy, and got rid of him. Joy is the only goal, Kondo said, addressing the group, and the room nodded yes, yes, in emphatic agreement, mouths agape in wonder that something so simple needed to be taught to them. My dream is to organize the world, Kondo said. The crowd cheered, and Kondo raised her arms into the air like Rocky. When she enters a new home, Kondo says, she sits down in the middle of the floor to greet the space. She says that to fold a shirt the way everyone folds a shirt, a floppy rectangle, instead of the way she thinks you should, a tight mass of dignified envelope-shaped fabric so tensile that it could stand upright, is to deprive that shirt of the dignity it requires to continue its work, that is, hanging off your shoulders until bedtime. She would like your socks to rest. She would like you to thank your clothes for how hard they work and ensure that they get adequate relaxation between wearings. Before you throw them out, and who boy will you be throwing them out, she wants you to thank them for their service. She is tiny, just 4'8". When I interviewed her, not only did her feet not touch the ground when we were sitting, but her knees didn't even bend over the side of the couch. When she speaks, she remains pleasant-faced and smiling. The only visible possessions in her hotel room for a 2-week trip from Tokyo were her husband's laptop and a small silver suitcase the size of a man's briefcase. Her ankles are skinny, but her wrists are muscular. When she shows pictures of herself in places she has tidied, before she starts, she looks like a lost sparrow in a tornado. In the after picture, it is hard to believe that such a creature could effect such change. Her success has taken her by surprise. She never thought someone could become so famous for tidying that it would be hard to walk down the street in Tokyo. I feel I am busy all the time and I work all the time, she said, and she did not seem so happy about this, though her smile never wavered. Kondo does not feel threatened by different philosophies of organization. She leaves room for something that people don't often give her credit for, that the KonMari method might not be your speed. In Japan, there are at least 30 organizing associations, whereas in the United States, we have just one major group, the National Association of Professional Organizers, NAPO. Kondo herself has never heard of NAPO, though she did tell me that she knows the profession exists in the United States. I haven't had a chance to talk to anyone in particular, but what I've heard is that thanks to my book and organizing method, now the organizing industry in general kind of bloomed and got a spotlight on it, she said. They kind of thanked me for how my book and method changed the course of organizing industry in America. The women, and maybe 3 or 4 men, of NAPO would beg to differ. More than 600 of them descended on Atlanta for NAPO's annual meeting in May. They refer to this gathering only as conference, no article, the way that insiders call the CIA just CIA. I went along, too, in order to better understand the state of stuff in America and to study Kondo's competition. At conference, I met women who organize basements. I met women who organize digital clutter and those who organize photos. I met a woman who organizes thoughts. And please don't move on to the next sentence until you've truly absorbed that. I met a woman who charges $100 per hour for the organization of thoughts. I heard the word detritus pronounced 3 different ways. Conference was different from the KonMari events that I attended. Whereas Kondo does not believe that you need to buy anything in order to organize and that storage systems provide only the illusion of tidiness, The women of conference traded Recon on time-saving apps, label makers, the best kind of Sharpie, the best tool they own, super sticky notes, drawer dividers, and the best practices regarding clients who won't offer their organization goals in a timely manner. I heard about the crises in the industry, that there are clients who print out Pinterest pages and say, I want that, that the baby boomers are downsizing for the first time, and there is a rising generation that isn't interested in inheriting their parents' old junk. While NAPO members don't share any standardized method for organizing, they are fairly unified in their disdain for this Japanese interloper. They have waged a war through their fuming blog posts and their generally disgusted conversations, saying that she is a product only of good marketing, that she's not doing anything different from what they've been doing since she was in diapers. They don't like that there's prescribed order for tidying. They think you have to yield to what your client wants done and has time for. They don't like the once-in-a-lifetime tidying marathon, which on average is completed in 6 months. Sometimes organizing is a many years effort. They don't like that she has really addressed what to do with all your kids' stuff. At the opening night cocktails trade show, I asked some women eating spring rolls what they had against Kondo. The nice ones, struggling for something that wasn't overtly bitchy to say, said they appreciated that the popularity of her book has brought attention to their industry, which still lobbies to be recognized by the government as an official occupation. But they also feel as if they've been doing this for years, and she has just been one hell of a marketing machine. But she's doing nothing so different from us, at least three of them said to me. Each organizer I spoke with said that she had the same fundamental plan that Kondo did, that the client should purge what is no longer needed or wanted. Somehow the extra step of thanking the objects or folding it a little differently enrages them. This rage hides behind the notion that things are different here in America, that our lives are more complicated and our stuff is more burdensome and our decisions are harder to make. It's a book if you're a 20-something Japanese girl and you live at home and you still have a bunch of your Hello Kitty toys and stuff, another NAPO member told me. They even hate Kondo's verbiage. The word she uses, tidying, is annoying and arcane to them. Tidying is what you do before your mother-in-law comes over, said one woman, while her two friends nodded. In addition, what Kondo offers is limited. Ellen Fay, the president of NAPO, told me, you know, I have a client who got me the book. I did page through it. I think her first book is kind of like the grapefruit diet, that there's nothing wrong with just eating grapefruit. It's not going to get it all done. Ultimately, the women of NAPO said that Kondo's methods were too draconian and that the clients they knew couldn't live in Kondo's world. They had jobs and children, and they needed baby steps and hand-holding and maintenance plans. They needed someone to do for them what they couldn't naturally do for themselves. The last time I saw Marie Kondo, we were in a hotel room in New York, a different one, and still the only visible objects in it were that metal suitcase and her husband's laptop. But one item had been removed from the suitcase, a spray bottle that she keeps around. She sprays it into the air, and the scent signals to her that she is finished working for the day, that her obligations, which seem endless lately, are done. I think the NAPO women have Kondo wrong. She is not one of them, intent on competing for their market share. She is not part of a breed of alpha organizer solopreneurs bent on dominating the world. She has more in common with her clients. But when it comes to stuff, we are all the same. Once we've divided all the drawers and eliminated that which does not bring us joy and categorized ourselves within an inch of our lives, we'll find that the person lying beneath all the stuff was still just plain old us. We're all a mess, even when we're done tidying. At least Kondo knows it. I was always more comfortable talking to objects than people, she told me. At that moment, I could tell that if she had her way, I would leave the hotel room and she would spray her spray and be left alone so she could ask the empty room if she could clean it. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read one of the obituaries. The Lakota chief who taught John Wayne to shoot. David Bald Eagle, 1919 to 2016. David Bald Eagle lived many lives. He was a champion dancer, both ballroom and Lakota, a war hero, a touring musician, an actor, a stuntman, and a race car driver. He danced with Marilyn Monroe and taught John Wayne how to shoot from a horse. Yet his first priority was always his heritage. Chief of the Minkajou Band of Lakota, Bald Eagle spent much of his life teaching people about Native American life and encouraging other indigenous groups to take pride in their history. I know we can't go back to where we were, he said, but we can tell the young ones how it was. And they can remember, and they can bring it back. Raised on a reservation in South Dakota, David William Beautiful Bald Eagle Jr. did not go to school or speak English until he was 12. He joined the U.S. Army as a horse trainer in 1939 and volunteered for the 82nd Airborne after the Pearl Harbor attacks. Bald Eagle won the Silver Star for his role in the 1944 invasion of Anzio, Italy. But his war ended later that year when he was shot multiple times during the Normandy D-Day landings. On his return home, Bald Eagle played drums in a Minnesota-based big band and married English dance teacher Penny Rathburn. The pair became champion ballroom dancers. But in 1946, Penny died in a car crash while 4 months pregnant. Suicidal, Bald Eagle took up dangerous pursuits, trying race car driving, skydiving, and bareback bull riding. But when chasing death, he came across success. His horse riding skills made him a sought-after stunt double, and he appeared in dozens of Hollywood films, including River of No Return, 1954 with Monroe, and the Oscar-winning Dances with Wolves, 1990. Bald Eagle met his second wife, Belgian actress José Kesteman, while performing in a Wild West show at the World's Fair in Belgium in 1958. They courted for years and married in 1973. After settling down, Bald Eagle became chief of the Minkajou Lakota and later first chief of the United Native Nations, which represents a number of tribes. He never lost his sense of adventure. He rode his last bucking horse when he was 72 years old, on a dare, said his son, Killy Bald Eagle. That's my dad. Let's get two of the health and science articles today. The first, earliest ancestor of living things. How and where life arose out of inanimate matter is a mystery that has long consumed evolutionary biologists. Charles Darwin famously speculated that the first living things arose in some warm little pond. But a new genetic study suggests life first formed in a far less hospitable environment. Scalding deep-sea hydrothermal vents. Gas-filled plumes created by the interaction of seawater and magma erupting through the ocean floor. Biologist at Heinrich Heine University in Germany arrived at that conclusion after creating a detailed genetic profile of a 4-billion-year-old organism dubbed LUCA, an acronym for the Last Universal Common Ancestor. The researchers examined 6.1 million protein-coding genes found in bacteria and archaea, single-celled organisms with no nucleus, that eventually gave rise to all plants and animals. The New York Times reports, after arranging the genes in evolutionary family trees, they found that 355 likely originated from LUCA. The genetic reconstruction suggests LUCA thrived in an intensely hot setting, devoid of oxygen, and relied on hydrogen and metals for energy, precisely the conditions in deep sea vents. I was flabbergasted at the result. I couldn't believe it, says study leader William Martin. His research doesn't confirm that life began in the vents. Some biologists believe the first organism started out on land, but may have been propelled underseas 4 billion years ago after a shower of asteroids and comets reshaped the planet. A map of the human brain. Neuroscientists have been forced to rely on a relatively rough diagram of the human brain to perform delicate surgeries or research treatments for debilitating disorders like Alzheimer's and schizophrenia. But a new map created at Washington University in St. Louis is being hailed as a milestone, providing the most detailed picture yet of the cerebral cortex, the brain's outermost layer involved in language, consciousness, and problem solving. The brilliantly colored image reveals 180 distinct areas within this wrinkled mass of gray matter, including 97 that were previously unknown. The map was created using MRI scans of 210 healthy adult brains at rest and brains performing simple tasks. Researchers drew lines around specific regions of the cerebral cortex based on their structure, function, and connectivity with other parts of the brain. The map provides neuroscientists with a typical brain template that could shed light on how the mind is affected by disorders like dementia, autism, and epilepsy. You know what maps of the world looked like in 1500, and you know what they looked like in 1950, asked National Institute of Mental Health's Dr. Greg Farber. I think in terms of resolution and quality, we've moved from 1500 to 1950. On the Talking Points page now. Clinton, why aren't more women excited? Hillary Clinton just became the first woman to win the presidential nomination of a major party, said Eleanor Clift in thedailybeast.com. So why is the response so oddly muted? Young women take Clinton for granted. For them, the struggle for women to be taken seriously in a male-dominated world and to get elected to public office is ancient history, like World War I. They can't appreciate what it took for Clinton to escape her husband's shadow and, after he'd humiliated her, forge her own political career. Many older women also don't like Hillary, viewing her as an entitled opportunist who cuts corners and gets away with it. Maybe the transformative nature of Clinton's achievement won't sink in until Inauguration Day, when a woman will stand alone, her hand on the Bible, as the new leader of the Western world. 8 years of the first black president has killed off hopes for transformative change, said Ben Dominic in TheFederalist.com. Barack Obama's fervent supporters were certain his election would be a mark of racial healing, a sign of how far we have come as a country. Instead, we've seen the further rise of identity politics and tribalism, and the perception that race relations are worse than they have been in more than two decades. No wonder Hillary's nomination isn't raising Obamian expectations about gender. Besides, her nomination will have a negligible effect on the lives of American women, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. It's not news that women can seek high office, see Sarah Palin and Carly Fiorina, or run a major corporation like IBM, GM, or PepsiCo. In 2016, it shouldn't be necessary for a dreadful politician to take the next step in her dreadful career for little girls to realize they can live their dreams. Every time I say, wow, this is meaningful, some sour Republican or Sanders supporter tells me not to get excited about Clinton's nomination, said Melissa Batchelor-Warnk in Los Angeles Times. These naysayers then complain about something Clinton did wrong in 1998, or call her a warmonger, or complain about her emails for the 500th time. By no means do I approve of everything Hillary has ever done, but because of her grit, intelligence, and determination, a woman is now poised to step into a job held by men for more than two centuries. Regardless of how you feel about her, recognize the significance of this moment. It will not come again. And a short note to follow that about Hillary Clinton. When Hillary Clinton graduated from Wellesley in 1969, only 8% of women had completed 4 years of college and 42% held jobs outside of the home. Women married at an average age of 21. Today, 33% of women have graduated from college, 58% hold paying jobs, and women marry at an average age of 27. Finally, a quote from George Carlin. It's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.